550 WFTL. I'm Karen Curtis, and I'm here again today, as we are each Sunday at noon, with attorneys Eric Glazer and Scott Shapiro from Glazer & Associates PA, a law firm practicing community association law throughout Florida. Our listeners know that we are here each week to answer all of your calls and emails about the issues that make life in your condominium or HOA absolutely crazy from one minute to the next. As always, we would love to get the phone lines going early, answering all of your questions, so give us a call right here in our studio at 877-850-8585. Again, that's 877-850-8585. Or if you prefer to email us your questions, you can do so by visiting the show's website at condocrazeandhoas.com and by clicking the email the show tab.
And of course, even if you don't want to send us an email, you should still visit the show's website at condocrazeandhoas, where you can listen to all of our past shows, sign up for our free seminars, a lot of which are coming up real soon. You can see who the show's sponsors are and visit all of their websites. You can see what legislation we're demanding from our elected officials. We're going to talk about that today, and which elected officials are in your corner and which are not. And of course, you can also automatically link to our Facebook page and join in our discussions about the show, or start your own discussion board and get feedback from everybody else.
And by the way, if you have a product or service that would be beneficial to our listeners and want to be a guest on our show, attend our monthly seminars where you meet hundreds of different associations, be listed on the show's website, and have a commercial spot during each week's show, you can become a sponsor of the show. Just visit the show's website at condocrazeandhoas.com and send us a quick email.
And, of course, if you'd like to call our law firm directly and pick our brains off the air, you can call Glazer & Associates at 954-983-1112. Again, 954-983-1112. And you can visit the law firm's website at condo-laws.com. Again, that's condo-laws.com. And finally, again, thank you to so many of you for supporting the Community Association Membership Party and for throwing your support behind our six legislative proposals. And to find out more about how you can get involved and demand long overdue changes to both the condo and HOA statutes, again, visit www.camp2012.net. That's www.camp2012.net. And as a matter of fact, if there ever was a day to reread what legislative proposals we stand for, today might be that day.
Yes, right.
Because we'll get into that soon.
Okay. Well, the last show we spoke about how borrowers who continued making their mortgage payments during the foreclosure crisis are about to be rewarded by the federal government. The blown-up mailbox of an HOA president, an HOA board who towed the car of the babysitter who was watching the kids while mommy was out giving birth, and how timeshare complaints apparently outnumber condo and HOA complaints combined.
Yeah, which is why I can really, again, never say in good conscience, and recommend the purchasing of a timeshare unit. And indeed, our Attorney General, Pam Bondi, believes that passing some new timeshare legislation is the most important thing that the Florida legislature needs to be concentrating on right now. But on the other hand, though, let's talk about Florida Senator Christopher Smith. He's a Democrat representing District 29 in Broward County, and he thinks it's more important to take care of the condo mess that many of our listeners find themselves in today. And he's actually filed a new bill in the Florida Senate that, while well-intentioned, is certainly controversial.
I agree, Eric. I think his heart's in the right place. But Senator Smith's bill is really one sentence, and here's what it says. The share of common expenses of a unit in the condominium, which is in foreclosure, may not be assessed against other units in the condominium.
Yeah, let's repeat it. It's a short sentence, but it actually says a lot. And again, this is what it says. The share of the common expenses of a unit in the condominium, which is in foreclosure, may not be assessed against other units in the condominium. Now, we're going to have Senator Smith on the show here live next week, so don't forget to tune in next week, and perhaps we can get an explanation from him as to how this legislation would actually work. But I guess, what the legislation is trying to say is that nobody in a condominium should have to pay more money in assessments just because their neighbors' homes are in foreclosure. Now, I would guess, obviously, that the senator's constituents are, like, bombarding his office all the time about increases in their assessments as a result of more and more of the neighbors slipping into foreclosure. And this is Senator Smith's attempt to do something about it. But with all due respect to the senator, I don't think this bill is actually the way to go, and we'll get into why.
Well, isn't the whole idea of a condominium the fact that everyone gets to share expenses, chip in for things like the insurance, the electricity, the security, and other things that everyone receives the benefit of?
Absolutely, yeah.
But, of course, everyone knows in that the flip side to that is if someone doesn't pay, the rest of the neighbors have to chip in even more.
Exactly, Karen. That's exactly how a condo works. And if some of the neighbors stop paying their assessments because they're in foreclosure, these bills that you just mentioned, like the electricity, like the insurance, they still have to get paid no matter what. That's the bottom line. They got to get paid, even if it means an increase in assessments to the unit owners who are paying their dues. And that's what sometimes makes the condominium concept, you know, hard to swallow.
Yeah. And, you know, again, we all think that the senator is, you know, basically meaning very well by proposing this bill. And, you know, in practicality, there is simply no way to implement this proposal. And I think all of our listeners will know the reason is, you know, let's say something like 20% of the owners are in foreclosure at a condo and they're not paying their assessments. Does that mean that the insurance company that you guys have a contract with is going to accept 80% of their outstanding bill, or the electric company, or any other contract that you guys have out there? I don't think
so. Of course not. But like you said, his heart's in the right place. We just got to figure out how to get that heart to pass some legislation that will work. So while it sounds like a very owner-friendly bill, the reality is that if an association was only allowed to pay a percentage of its outstanding bills that equals the same percentage of only paying unit owners, you know, people would have their lights turned off, their insurance canceled, the landscaping stopped, and the water turned off. But again, next week we're going to have Senator Smith on the show to discuss his proposal and a lot more, and we will certainly give him the opportunity to prove us wrong.
You're very fair.
Yeah, absolutely, and we will be fair. Again, to me, at least a partial answer to this mess is not that complicated, and it simply requires the Florida legislature to finally stand up to the banking industry. How about that? Again, stand up to the banking industry. And again, how about our community association membership party, our proposals, getting them passed, which would require the banks to pay 2% of the mortgage amount to the association when they foreclose and take back a unit, rather than the silly 1% the statute actually requires today. That's a no-brainer.
Yes.
Well, you know, I'm guessing that the senator, who is a Democrat, is going to tell us a lot about why the legislature up in Tallahassee, which is dominated by Republicans, simply refuses to go after the banks, and why asking for the cap to be raised to 2% is probably like pulling teeth.
Yeah, or worse than that. There's just simply nobody who's willing to stand up to the banks. But as we say week in and week out here, the damage that the banking industry has done and continues to do to the state of Florida, it's really simply at this point incalculable. And the damage they've done to the court system alone by filing thousands and thousands of false affidavits, which really has caused such tremendous delays to the foreclosure process, it warrants, at least in my opinion, the absolute severest of sanctions possible. And I can tell you that based upon a recent article on the Daily Business Review, some of our local judges feel that they need the legislature to help them out by writing new laws which would give them the ability to sanction banks that commit these fraud or purposeful delays in the foreclosure process. And I can tell you, they feel a tremendous sense of frustration at the pace of the foreclosure process. So here's my take on this. Any legislator not willing to support a raise in the cap that a bank has to pay to a condo or HOA from 1% to 2% of their mortgage, they're in effect then just a puppet for the banking industry, absolutely no friend to the state of Florida, and any of their constituents who live in a community association. And they should be tossed out when they come up for re-election. Really, a no-brainer.
Quite simple.
Now, let's do this. Let's take our first break. And when we get back, we're going to talk about our upcoming free Condo Craze Board Certification Seminar at the Hard Rock Hotel in Hollywood, Florida, this coming Thursday night. We're going to talk about a new bill in the U.S. Senate that would allow foreigners to obtain a visa to this country if they agree to buy a home, believe it or not, worth $500,000 or more. And believe it or not, it has bipartisan support. We'll talk about the fact that Floridians are apparently not having babies like we used to. And, of course, we'll take your calls about anything else you want to talk about in the crazy community association world. Give us a call right here in the studio at 877-850-8585. Again, that's 877-850-8585, and we will be back right after this.
Why can't we be friends? Why can't we be friends? Why can't we be friends? Why can't we be friends?
Welcome Welcome back to Condo Craze and HOAs here on 850 WFTL. Again, I'm Karen Curtis with attorneys Eric Glazer and Scott Shapiro from Glazer & Associates. We are taking your calls at 877-850-8585. That's 877-850-8585. And we have Sal from West Palm Beach on the line. Hi, Sal. You're on the air.
All right. Thank you. Our annual meeting is on February 8th. When do the residents have to, they want to run for the board? How long before that do they have to write in?
Typically, what's required by statute is you have to mail out the package 60 days before that February 8th annual meeting. And once the package...
Mail out the package if they want to run, in other words.
Yeah. No, the package gets sent out to the unit owner 60 days in advance, right? And
right.
Then... I think they have to get their notice in within 40 days that they actually want to run for the board. And then the board sends out the package with at least 14 days notice once they actually have the ballots prepared.
Okay, the ballots that go out that the people vote is 14 days.
Yeah, it's got to be at least 14 days, right, in advance of the annual meeting. That's correct.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, all right,
Appreciate
Sal, thank you. All right, the phones are going nutso. How about we go to Cindy in Delray Beach?
Hi, how are you?
Hey, Cindy. Good morning.
Good morning. Quick question. My husband and I own a condominium in Boynton. The condominium that we reside in Delray is, for financial reasons, only owned by my husband.
Okay.
He has been screened. And subsequently, when I came down, I was not screened. And my question is this, in looking over the condo docs, he is the owner. I'm not leasing it. We are family and married. Am I required to be screened?
Gotta look at your documents. There's a good chance that you're not required to be screened if you're not, if you're not actually an owner. But some documents say everybody who's going to be permanently residing in the unit needs to be screened. Some documents don't. Let's say it does not.
Yeah, these appear not to have that.
So then, generally, you look at other provisions of the documents, like if most of the documents have like boilerplate language. Scott, help me out here. Basically, something to the extent that you're allowed to use the unit for single family unit use, and arbitration decisions have always held. Well, obviously, then that means your wife can stay there without being screened as well.
Yeah, I mean, it even goes beyond
exactly
that.
Exactly what it says.
Yeah, it even goes beyond that. There are a lot of, Supreme Court decisions, Supreme Court of the United States for that matter, that, basically says the definition of a single family is so fluid and can mean so many things that to deny somebody, especially now a wife here, the privilege of living within the unit that her husband owns.
Yeah,
I just don't see it happening.
Yeah, not going to happen.
But, the last thing you ever want to do is, not be as, forward and transparent with the board as possible. So if you go in there and say, hey, I'm his wife. I don't know if you have a screening process or not. I mean, I'm sure there won't be any problems. But, maybe we can just get this out of the way to avoid any type of dispute down the road. That wouldn't be the worst thing in the world either.
Yeah, not to stray too far off the topic, but I can tell you that generally the decisions of the arbitrators in Tallahassee have held that anybody sharing the bills basically to pay the house and help run the household, you're considered a family, whether that be two guys, two girls, extended family members, whatever it is. If you're sharing bills, you're a family.
Yeah, for me, I'm not worried about the screen. I just don't – I get my credit tapped enough.
Right.
I don't want my score being affected by this – frivolous requirement.
Right. And again, it might be frivolous, it might not. We'd have to take a look at the documents, okay? If you'd like, give us a call at the office, 954-983-1112. Again, 954-983-1112, and I'd be glad to go over your documents with you.
Excellent.
Okay?
Thanks so much.
Okay, Cindy, thank you. All right, how about we go to Phil in Boca?
Hi, I'll try to make this simple. I'm in an HOA in a bunch of the residents have gotten together because we heard that the board of directors has sued one of the residents, and they're actually in litigation, and nobody in the community knows about it except the board.
Well,
isn't that a problem, and isn't the membership supposed to know when there's a lawsuit in process?
What type of lawsuit are we talking about?
They don't know.
The non-payment of the dues and And things like that.
No, I don't think, with all due respect, Phil, I don't think the board has to let the homeowners know every time it intends on filing a foreclosure action against the unit owner that's not paying. I will tell you that you're in an HOA, and the HOA statute does have something a little different in it. The HOA statute, unlike the condo statute, basically says if you're going to sue or get involved in a lawsuit where the amount of controversy exceeds $100,000, then you have to get permission from the unit owners. Other than that, there's nothing in the statute that would require, at least to me, the board getting permission from the unit owners or even notifying the unit owners that you filed one foreclosure suit.
Yeah, and on top of that, you know, all civil suits here in the state of Florida, especially those that have to do with HOAs and condos, are public record. So, you know, if you're really that curious about what your board's up to with respect to the court system, you can always check the clerk of the court's docket yourself.
Well, of course, one of the main things is, without dealing with the reason for the suit, is that the exposure to the homeowners if the board does not prevail.
Well, you elected the board. You know, you entrusted them with the ability to make decisions on your behalf. If you don't trust their decision making, you know, that just basically means you need to elect other people. But it doesn't sound like they're doing anything wrong.
Right. Absolutely. I think the board gets a pass on this one, Phil.
Okay.
All right. Okay. How about we go to Blaine in Palm City?
Yes. I live in a homeowners association under 720.
Yes.
And we have restrictions, rules, and covenants, bylaws that were written by the developer 35 years ago.
Okay.
And they have been modified and changed during the subsequent years up until now. Now we have just improved our facility. It's a private airport community. We've just improved our facilities, and we have to make some new rules and regulations in regards to the improvements that we've made. And we were told by an attorney who is a member of our board that we have to have 100% subscription to any change or deletion in our bylaws or our covenants and restrictions. And we also have to have consent approval by any mortgage holder on some property that is a voting member of it. Is this correct?
Okay.
I've scanned down 720, and I've been unable to find what the rules and regulations are in regards to how much percentage of people you need to change things. Can you enlighten me a little?
Yeah, this is actually a good phone call, and on the call, two calls ago, I recommended to Cindy that she gives me a call in the office to review her documents. I would absolutely recommend that to you, Blaine, because you started off your phone call saying that the original documents in your HOA were recorded 35 years ago. Now, Florida has something called MRTA, which is the Marketable Record Title Act, and basically speaking, HOA covenants, they can expire after 30 years if they're not recorded. Now, again, I don't know if there's been amendments.
He actually said there have been.
Right, but I don't know when those amendments were actually done, that whether or not that restarted the 30-year clock. But before we even talk about whether or not you can amend your documents, we first got to find out whether or not your documents actually even exist at all. And then let's assume that your documents do exist and you want to amend them. Then we got to take a look at the amendment provisions of those governing documents. So, and it depends what they actually say. Some documents may require 100%. Typically, they require either 66% or 75%. So I don't know. You know, I have no reason to say whether or not that other attorney on the board is right or wrong, because I would need to see your documents and actually to give you an intelligent answer in that regard. But the first thing we got to look at is whether or not those covenants actually expired after the 30 years. That's really important. Okay?
Well, one of the languages that every 10 years you have the option of renewing them or changing them.
Right. Okay, well, it
says that in those original documents.
Right, and I got to see whether or not the procedures in that document were filed.
We're at that point of that anniversary of the 10-year.
I got you.
But we're in limbo as to know what percentage of requirements we need to make the changes, because the original documents do not specify that you need
80%, 70%, or 100% subscription.
What I need you to do is give me a call in the office, and I'd be glad to go over this with you one-on-one. Give me a call at 954-983-1112. Again, 954-983-1112, and I will be glad to walk us both through it. How about that?
1112.
Right.
And your name?
Eric Glazer, okay?
And 954-983-1112.
There you go, Blaine. Thanks for the phone call. Okay, all right. Taking your calls, 877-850-8585. Again, 877-850-8585. Remember, as of last week, Glazer & Associates, we're really proud to say we have a new office in beautiful Baldwin Park in Orlando,
woo-hoo!
Florida. Yeah, really nice place, I have to tell you. And we certainly look forward to representing associations and owners in that area. And not just that, of course, we're going to be bringing the Condo Craze Board Certification course to Orlando on December 3rd at 1 o'clock at the Hard Rock Hotel in Orlando, which is right next to Universal Studios. Again, that's December 3rd at 1 o'clock. And anyone interested in attending the Orlando seminar just has to register online again at condocrazeandhoas.com. I can tell everyone also that for the Orlando seminar, we modified the material slightly to also teach a lot of HOA law, again, because the fact that there are a lot more HOAs in that neck of the woods than there are condos. So HOA members, we'd like you to feel free to attend, and I promise you will learn a lot about your community as well.
And as we told you last week, one of our Camp 2012 proposals regarding HOAs is already on its way to becoming law, and that's the requirement that every HOA board member gets certified, and not just condo board members anymore.
Right, absolutely. And I'll tell you this, before we talk about the seminar that's upcoming this Thursday night, let's take our next break. Taking your calls at 877-850-8585. Again, 877-850-8585. We will be back right after this.
Why can't we be friends? Why can't we?
The second half hour of Condo Craze and HOAs here on 850 WFTL. Again, I'm Karen Curtis with attorneys Eric Glazer and Scott Shapiro from Glazer & Associates. We are taking your calls at 877-850-8585. 877-850-8585. We see you on the line there, but wait. Eric does a wonderful free seminar.
Exactly. This coming Thursday. We were talking about the one we're going to do in Orlando on December 3rd, but a lot sooner than that. As a matter of fact, this coming Thursday night at the Hollywood Hard Rock Hotel and Casino, we're going to teach the Condo Craze Board Certification Seminar yet again. And I can tell you there's really just a few seats remaining.
Wow.
I'm certainly anticipating all of the seats are going to be reserved and accounted for by tomorrow at the latest. But you can still get in perhaps by getting there a little early Thursday night and waiting on the standby line. And believe it or not, we actually had somebody sign up this morning from Panama City. They're making like a 9-hour drive, 10-hour drive just to come to the seminar.
Nothing else is available.
Yeah, I know.
You're the only guy.
Now we're the guy, and we much appreciate it.
Yeah, well, we always have participants fill out evaluation forms at the end of the seminar, and everyone always says the same thing. Yeah. They were amazed at the amount of material we cover in such a short period. And again, we cover all kinds of topics like what every association now needs to know in light of the Cohn case, association budgets, mandatory financial reporting, fiduciary duties of board members, arbitration, mediation, and all of the laws that have been passed over the last few years. There's a lot of coffee and cake and endless questions from our audience. It's really a lot of fun.
Yeah, I can tell you it always is. And again, like I said, this year, Brian, our office manager at Glazer & Associate, he went a little crazy, and now participants in both Orlando and Hollywood, you guys have shots of winning lots of prizes when you attend, like iPods, watches, gambling chips, giant screen TVs, Kindles, and a lot more. And in addition, all of our show sponsors are going to be there as well with all of their products and all their service that they can provide to your community. And again, just to remind everybody, as of July 1st, the law now provides you can become certified 1 year before getting elected to the board, or within 3 months of actually getting elected to the board. So you don't need to actually wait to get elected to the board to take the course. And there's actually a school of thought that says if you're thinking about running for the board in your upcoming election, why not take the course now and get certified? And you can actually promote the fact that you're already certified when you do, in fact, decide to run. And great news for CAMS, the course provides 4 continuing education credits for all community association managers, and many, many CAMS have attended the seminar together normally with the directors of the board that in the condo that they manage. And the CAMS are great to have because, so like I keep saying, they really keep us attorneys on our toes. So remember, if you want to register for either of the seminars, go to CondoCrazeAndHOAs.com. And on that note, how about we go to June in Delray Beach? Hi, June.
Hello.
June, how are you?
Hi, this is an opportunity for me. I'm a real estate broker, and I have an executed contract purchase of I represent the buyer on a condominium. The buyer has asked me to find out how many owners in the building are behind in their maintenance. Is the association or the management company obligated to give me that information?
I don't think they're obligated to give that to you. I think what can be done is that the owner can make that request for copies of the record showing who's actually delinquent. Or what the owner can do is make either you or the potential buyer the owner's representative to get records. But I don't think they're responsible for actually turning over those records to any potential buyer, no.
You can't have a deadbeat list.
No, absolutely. Can't give that out to people that are not actually the owners of the condominium or the designated representative of that owner. So, you know, can you get them? Yes, but you're going to have to ask the seller for some help in that regard.
Right. Can the seller's agent get that information, representing the seller?
Yeah, that's actually a good point. Yeah, if the seller gives the authority to her agent to act as her representative to get records, then yes, those records can be gotten by the seller's agent. Absolutely.
Okay, well, that's great information. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Hope the sale goes through.
That's kind of smart, though. I mean, ahead of time.
Absolutely. Find out. Of course, you know, you can also find out, when we say this all the time, you know, Scott mentioned it earlier. Everything, you know, all these cases that are in foreclosure, it's all public records. So actually, before buying a condo unit, maybe you want to go online to the clerk's office of in the county where the property is located, punch in the name of the condominium, and find out just how many active foreclosures they have going on in the court system. Not too difficult to find out. And again, if you're not sure how to do it, just call us and ask. And on that note, how about we go to Robert in West Palm Beach?
Hi, how are you?
How are you, Robert?
Fine, thanks. I'm glad you just mentioned going online at the county clerk's office, because that's what my question is about.
Yeah.
I recently inherited a condo in Palm Beach County in a 55-plus community. And I know that within the community there are some people I'm under 55, over 50, and was told I couldn't reside there. And I know there are some associations that allow people under the, I guess, the 80-20 rule, and some that do not.
Well,
I was told on more than one occasion that an amendment was passed to the bylaws in this association within the last 4 years that was the strictest of all, 55 plus only, even to the point that a younger spouse, if the older spouse passed away,
no,
would have to leave.
Nope.
Now, I've been told about the amendment, and I've asked to see the amendment, and I wanted to see the wording, and I was told to go on the website. I went on the website, and although the declaration is there from 1970, whatever, although there are many other bylaws, there are a few bylaws that people keep referring to that appears was never recorded at the county clerk's office.
If it's never recorded, then it simply doesn't control anything in the community. Is there an original recorded declaration, though, that does in fact make you a 55 and over community or make this community a 55 and over community?
The original declaration did not. It does look like in the 90s there was one passed that did, but it seems that several of the individual associations since 2005 have been rewriting their bylaws with similar but not identical wording. So I don't know if there was a loophole somewhere between the 90s, you know, that they're tightening up.
Robert, you know, this, now you're telling me there's multiple associations, so this is something that we'd actually have to, you know, look at with, you know, what the documents are before we can give you a real intelligent answer. But the fact of the matter is,
my actual question was just, if it's not recorded,
If it's not recorded, it doesn't mean a thing.
Yeah, if it's not recorded, it doesn't mean a thing.
They only take effect when they're recorded. But let me just get to one thing, if you don't mind. That 80-20 rule, everybody always gets confused on that 80-20 rule. A lot of people think that in a 55 and over community, let's say the community is at 90% where it's occupied by at least one person each 55 and over, that means that if I want to sell my unit now to someone who's not going to have a 55 and over occupant, I could do it because then the community will still be above 80%. They'll be at 89% or 87% or whatever it is. That's not how it works. That 80% number, that's simply a threshold number to make the community into a 55 and over community, meaning that a community cannot become a 55 and over community unless 80% of the units are occupied by someone age 55 and over. It does not mean that once you hit that 80% number and you go to, let's say, 90%, that there's a 10% play to sell units, to allow the sale of units to someone who's not 55 or over.
Also, you know, the association that you have a unit in also needs to be, you know, registering itself every couple of years with the Florida Commission on Human Relations in Tallahassee. And you can go online and check them out. It's the Florida Commission on Human Relations. You can Google it up, and you can find to see if your condo is up to date with respect to registering itself as a 55 and over community, because they need to be taking surveys.
I believe it is.
Right. In addition to that, again, for the 55 and over communities that are listening out there, very, very important. You can lose your status as a 55 and over community if you do not take what's called reliable surveys of all of the units in the condominium, because you're going to have to prove that you have made a good faith effort to find out that there each and every unit is occupied by somebody, at least one person age 55 and over. And there's a case that was decided in the Southern District of Florida in federal court where a condo lost its 55 and over status because they weren't taking those reliable surveys at least once every 2 years. So again, the 55 and over communities that are listening, take what I just said very seriously. Make sure that either the board or your management company is taking a survey of each and every unit at least once every 2 years to make sure that the unit is occupied by at least one person age 55 and over, because if you don't do it, you're going to lose your status as a 55 and over community. And on that note, let's take our final break of the hour. We're taking your calls at 877-850-8585. Again, 877-850-8585, and we will be back right after this.
Why can't we be friends? Why can't we be friends? Why can't we be friends? Why can't we be friends?
Welcome back to the final segment of Condo Craze and HOAs here on 850 WFTL. Again, I'm Karen Curtis with attorneys Eric Glazer, Scott Shapiro from Glazer & Associates. We are taking your phone calls. It's been busy today. 877-850-8585. That's 877-850-8585.
Well, I tell you, during the break, we've been talking about that crazy story that's coming out of the state of Pennsylvania right now about Penn State University. It looks like they're going to soon be known as Pedophile State University.
Ooh.
Because the allegations that are coming out are just unbelievable. We can't figure out why ESPN is kind of ignoring it, though. Even the local papers seem to be reporting on it. But so far, they're getting a pass on ESPN, Scott, huh?
Well, it'll be...
it's Penn State or State Penn.
Yeah. Again, as a Miami fan, you know, they obviously... you know, I don't want to say Schadenfreude is what I'm feeling right now, because, you know, these allegations are just the most awful things
I
could possibly
imagine.
For those who don't know, the allegations are that a former coach was seen in 2002 abusing a 10-year-old in the showers at Penn State.
Yeah, and there's 8 kids involved, and, you know, Miami.
And the cops were never called.
And this is a guy that has been, you know, was the defensive coordinator at Penn State for a good 15, 20 years, and has been around the program the last 10 years. It's just the most disgusting thing I've
ever seen. Miami takes their players on a boat ride. You know, we're supposed
to get
the death penalty. Yeah, we're supposed to get the death penalty, but what's going on in Penn State is just unbelievable. Anyway, apparently we shouldn't worry if we can't find an American family to sell our home to, by the way, because according to Money Magazine, international purchases of American homes are ramping up. And a new Senate bill designed to stimulate the real estate market would actually encourage international investment in the U.S. even more, a bill which was co-sponsored by Chuck Schumer, who all you know is a Democrat from New York, and Mike Lee, a Republican from Utah, would actually grant a U.S. visa to international investors who agree to spend at least $500,000 on residential real estate here in the United States.
Well, listen to these stats, and you can see why these senators think that we should be doing everything we can to attract foreign real estate investors. Foreigners spent $82 billion buying U.S. homes in the last year, and that's up 24% from a year earlier. And that represents an full 8% of total U.S. sales.
That's incredible.
And as we all know, in places like South Florida, international buyers account for a whopping 25% of the market. And according to the article in Money Magazine, a majority of these sales in South Florida have gone to South Americans and Canadians, God bless them. And even better yet, overwhelmingly, international buyers pay in cash. No mortgage process involved at all.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, Karen, according to an article in the Sun Sentinel, 5 years ago, during the height of this real estate boom, cash deals, as we all know, they were very rare, and they basically only represented about 10% of all sales. But now, cash deals are so prevalent that real estate agents practically have investors on speed dial, they say, with some international investors buying 5 and 10 properties at a time.
Wow.
Cash deals, huh?
Yeah.
I don't know why that all sounds a little strange, that these buyers are willing to pay in cash all the time when they can borrow money so cheaply right now. But it seems that sellers are willing to take less for their property if all the cash is there.
Yeah, nobody wants to wait and see if their buyer actually is going to get approved or not. And apparently, foreign investors are not as interested in flipping these properties for a quick buck anymore. And instead, at least the articles say that they're looking to get into the red-hot renting market. But back to the new proposed legislation that lets you get a visa if you buy a home worth $500,000 or more. I think Scott and I were discussing this proposal in the office this week, and I can safely speak for Scott when I say that I think we both aren't thrilled about it. Maybe instead of the U.S. government doing all it can to help foreigners buy real estate in the United States, the government should do all it can
yes.
to help U.S. citizens keep the real estate that they already own in the United States instead of being forced to sell it to someone who's going to own it from overseas. You know, I got to tell you, it's enough that foreigners already have our American jobs. Do they have to have our American homes, too?
Good
well,
point.
That's not the main thing I'm upset about. I know that when it comes to immigrants, when immigrants come to this country by boat and they arrive at Ellis Island, the first thing they see is, on the base of the Statue of Liberty that says, give us your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to be free. This new legislation certainly seems to send a different message that says, give us your rich, and we'll give you a visa. Poor need not apply. And Eric, maybe I'm a little outdated here, and I don't know how many immigrants even come in through Ellis Island anymore. You know, it was Vito Corleone,
Canadian
the last
border.
One. But, our country is not about, our country was built on what that says. This is the land of opportunity for everybody, not the ones that can afford to buy $500,000 mini mansions.
I agree with you, Scott. I'm with you on this. But before everybody starts thinking that I'm in favor of opening the borders to everybody, that's not what I'm saying. I'm simply saying that I don't like a law that allows someone the right to buy their way in here, but only if they basically buy a piece of property that was probably formerly owned by an American who lost it because he probably lost his job, too, to that same foreign country that's now going to buy his house. But I would love to know what our listeners think about this proposal that apparently has some bipartisan support filed in the Senate. Give us a call, 877-850-8585. Again, 877-850-8585. Should you be able to buy your way into the United States with a visa if you buy some expensive property? But not only are we losing our homes to foreign countries, and not only are the people from the Northeast not moving here, like we spoke about on the other show, but now Florida is also experiencing a baby bust because Florida's birth rate has dipped since the recession began nearly 4 years ago. And according to the state's Office of Vital Statistics, there were more than 24,000 fewer babies born in Florida last year than in 2007. And that's equal to the population of Cooper City. And the number of babies dropped almost 10% in Palm Beach and Miami-Dade, while Broward was over over 7%.
The culprit, according to the experts, is that many young couples are fearful about their job status or financial security and are simply postponing plans to have kids.
This phenomenon is really not that uncommon because, according to statistics, a plummeting birth rate typically follows a community's rising unemployment. The higher the jobless rate, the deeper the drop in births. And this same study found that states such as Florida that endured the largest unemployment situation in 2007 and 2008 were most likely to experience relatively large fertility declines. By contrast, North Dakota, everybody's favorite place to live, with the nation's lowest unemployment rate of 3.1% in 2008, was only the state to record an increase in birth rates.
Hey,
so I guess goat watching or whatever they do up there is a thriving business.
Exactly how I feel about it. These stats aren't just scary, but they're sad. Unfortunately, a lot of people are simply being forced to admit, especially young people, they're being forced to admit that they can't afford to have kids right now. And as we know, the older you get and the more you wait, sometimes that makes it more difficult to even have kids in the first place. I wonder, though, if you took a survey of men and women as to why birth rates are down, if you get the same answers from members of the opposite sex, I'm guessing many men would blame the economy and finances and stress. But I bet you a lot of women would blame the invention of, like, the Internet, ESPN, and the fact that you can now watch, like, the World Series of Poker on TV all day long,
I'd just like to let all our 28 to 30-year-old female listeners to know that I'm currently single.
And are you saying that birth rates may be down because there's a lot more things to occupy a man's time today than maybe there used to be?
Well, I'm not saying anything other than it doesn't surprise me that the birth rate may be high in North Dakota because, after all, there isn't that much to do in North Dakota other than make babies. But South Florida is a different story. But I'd like to let our
everybody's out windsurfing. That's it.
But how about we let our listeners decide, especially our female listeners? Maybe that's a great new topic for a show maybe next week. Ladies, if you live in a condo or HOA, is your man as frisky as he was when you first met? Maybe just living in a condo or the HOA itself destroys your sex drive. I don't know. That's definitely possible, I can tell you. But that's
Where's
a topic.
Dr. Mitch?
That's a topic for another show, and it looks like on that note, we are nearing the end of the hour. Everybody, thank you so much for tuning in for yet another week of Condo Craze and HOAs. For those of you that are coming this Thursday night, we look forward to seeing you again. Not too late to register. Few seats left. Go to CondoCrazeAndHOAs.com, and we will see you next week. Have a great week, everybody.
Thank you.